Welcome to Inside the Newsroom, the Sentinel Records weekly podcast that takes a closer look at news and sports in Garland County. Hello and welcome to Inside the Newsroom. Today, the Sentinel Records managing editor Steve Moross and I are interviewing Cara Petro, Garland County's chief deputy prosecuting attorney.
Okay, well, I guess it's kind of a hypothetical of like how someone sort of goes through the system and how the system works. So let's say like somebody robbed a local convenience store, they got arrested, and now they're in jail. What happens at that point?
Okay, so there's two different options once someone is arrested. The first would be for them to go through district court, and that's the most normal way to do it. Probable cause finding has to be found within 72 hours, and that can be found by a district court judge at arraignment, or if it's like a murder, sometimes I just go ahead and direct file those. So that would just go directly into circuit, and when the judge signs a warrant on the information, it's probable cause is found, so they don't have to be seen in 72 hours. So that's the process. And then once they go into district court or circuit court, they're going to say not guilty. The purpose of this is because there's malpractice concerns, number one, Rule 37 concerns, which is basically claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, which would be one of the few things that you could appeal on a plea. It's very hard to plea and get an appeal, but if you have a bad attorney, that could happen. So that is a huge purpose of doing not guilty. There are a few exceptions when they do plead guilty at arraignment, but that's only going to happen in circuit court, and that's because, let's say they're a felon caught red-handed with a gun. They're going to have a parole rewrite. They're going to have to go back to ADC. They want their time to start running as soon as possible so they don't have to do more time in prison. But at that point in time, there's going to be a huge record made about why they're not being ineffective as an attorney, about how this is in their client's best interest and how, you know, in the affidavit it says that a gun was found on him. He confesses it's his gun. There's no appearance of a bad search or anything like that. And this is what the client wants to do to run his time with his parole rewrite. That is very rare. So basically, what we need to do, we have until omnibus to give them a case file. We get the case file from, to back up a little bit, we get the case file from law enforcement, hopefully within 30 days. Sometimes it's more like 45, 50, but we have to make a determination whether it is a felony within 60 days. And that's the purpose of felony review in district, is because we might leave it down in district, we might null pros it, or we might bound it over, or we might change the charges and still bound it over to make it a felony. But we have 60 days to make that decision. Normally, district court only sees misdemeanors, but which is like shoplifting, DWI, traffic.
Now, with misdemeanors, sometimes they can plead guilty right up front. Right? Because I know that happens a lot. Like a drunk driver comes in, he gets arrested, you know, Tuesday night, goes to court Wednesday morning. He has that option of just like, I don't want to fight it. You know, but with felonies, they almost have to go through the system.
Right? Yes, that's the difference. With misdemeanors, the stakes aren't quite as high. You can actually represent yourself as the misdemeanor. Right. It's just
because I see a lot of like shoplifters, and they'll just plead guilty. They just want to, you know, get it over with.
Right, and the penalty isn't going to be as big for a misdemeanor, right? So, like with a felony, if he just pleads guilty, and his defense attorney doesn't stop him, then theoretically the court could give him the max sentence. So if it's a Y felony, they could just give him life. There's no incentive for him to have a plea deal if he just pleads guilty.
Right, so. Right. And then somebody could argue that he didn't have effective counsel because, you know, he didn't even get a lawyer.
Mm-hmm, so, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
So once it goes, let's say that the case is decided to be a felony. So it will go to circuit court. It will get arraigned. If it's a violent crime or a sexual crime, we'll go ahead and do a no contact order, which we will have done in district, but because the jurisdictions are different, we'll do a new no contact order. We'll do, if it is a case where there's a high probability of a change of venue because it's high publicity, we'll do a gag order at that point in time, too. The purpose is to protect the defendant and the state from having any issues with having to do a change of venue and give everyone a fair trial because both sides deserve a fair trial.
Now, this might be a good time to address bonds because I know that's something a lot of people get confused about, and I see a lot of comments because one thing I see, especially like violent crimes, like somebody shoots somebody, stabs somebody, murder, whatever, a lot of times people are like, well, they shouldn't get a bond at all. But with rare exceptions, everybody's entitled to a bond, right?
Right. There's only a few exceptions to that. The first being, of course, capital murder. In the Arkansas Constitution, it says everyone is entitled to a bond, except for in capital murder cases, which it doesn't mean that they automatically don't get a bond in capital murder cases. You have to prove that the presumption is great to even get no bond on a capital murder case. And that is in the Arkansas Constitution. So everybody's entitled to a bond.
It can be really high. Like, you know, I've seen some that are $1,500,000, whatever.
Right, and there's factors that go into that. But before I go into the factors, I want to make sure to cover, there's not the same rules for post-conviction. So, like, if someone's on probation and they commit a new felony, then at that point in time they can have a zero bond because they've already been adjudicated and this is a new offense. Same thing with revoking a suspended sentence. If they commit a new felony while they're on bond, then they can have their bond revoked, or if they're on drugs. Basically, if they violate the conditions of their release of bond, that's how you get into a no bond situation. So
it's almost like they signed a contract.
Right. With their
which they violated.
With the court and with their bondsman. Gotcha. So
what would be next in that's like a
factors of bond, is that what
yeah,
you
yeah.
Okay, so what kind of bond a person gets is dependent on a number of factors which are in the rules of criminal procedure. For example, the seriousness of the crime. So there's different felonies. There's Class D all the way up to Class Y, Class Y being the most serious. So that's something that is taken into consideration, what level of felony we're talking about. Next is going to be the likelihood of conviction. How likely was this caught on video? Were there eyewitnesses? That kind of thing, confession. That will go into it. And then after that's evaluated, then you're going to look at their criminal history. Do they have a history of failing to comply with court orders, failing to appear at a court? Do they have a violent history? All that stuff is taken into account. And then the next thing would be ties to the community. What is their situation as far as work and family members in Garland County? What kind of property they own? Do they own any real property? Is there anything that ties them to keep them from fleeing Garland County? And that all goes into how a bond is set.
Now, is there always a hearing, or is sometimes that just, like, do y'all do that in office, or?
Pretty much there's always a hearing at first appearance. The prosecutor's going to argue for what bond they think is appropriate. The defense is going to. Very few times there can be, like, with property crimes and things like that, there might be an agreement on bond, so there doesn't have to be a hearing. But usually with the violent crimes and everything else, there's going to be a bond hearing.
Gotcha.
And then they have an opportunity after first appearance to file a motion to have their bond, like a full-blown hearing, like once we have witnesses, discovery, things like that.
Right. Now, I know, like, one thing with, you know, like getting into death penalty and all that, but how about if we just cover the different, like with murder, like what's the difference between capital murder, first-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter? Like, how is that kind of?
Okay, so each one has a totally different statute subsections. So to get to capital murder, you have to fit one of the subsections in the statute. And just because you get to capital murder doesn't mean you get to death penalty, because that's two different sections. So the first part is, does it fall into the category of capital murder? Was it premeditated? Was someone killed that was under the age of, I think it's 10 or 14? One of them's an aggravator, so I think it's 10. And then were they in the commission of, and then there's these felonies that are enumerated, and aggravated robbery, kidnapping, rape, are they in the commission of that kind of thing? That's what's going to make it capital. And at that point in time, it's just life that they're facing, life without parole. In Arkansas, life is life. You don't have to say life without parole, because everything is life in Arkansas.
It varies state to state, but here
in Arkansas, And so to get it to death penalty, you would have to have aggravating circumstances. And these aggravating circumstances also have to outweigh, beyond a reasonable doubt, any mitigating circumstances that the defense has. So there's a lot more hurdles to get to death penalty. For example, an aggravating circumstance would be killing more than one person in the same criminal episode. It would be for pecuniary gain. It would be targeting someone that was particularly vulnerable, and you knew that, like an elderly, couldn't get away to the, not just elderly, but very disabled elderly person or a child. And then you can't piggyback off of the fact that the aggravator is the same as the capital murder statute. So if it's aggravated robbery, pecuniary gain is not going to work. It's going to have to be a different kind of aggravator.
Right. So like if somebody went into a convenience store and ends up killing the clerk, it wouldn't automatically be a death penalty case. It would be capital murder, probably.
Yes, it would be capital.
Careful.
Oh, sorry.
but it wouldn't necessarily be death penalty unless there were
some other aggravating circumstances. Now, you can have an aggravating circumstance for other that are kind of similar, but that's just pecuniary gain's the big one that you got to be careful with.
Gotcha. Okay. You wanted to talk about the incentive of plea deals. Like, why? why that's sometimes a good thing to do is to work out a plea bargain or plea agreement.
So the reason plea deals happen is because otherwise we go to a jury trial and you don't know what a jury is going to do. You're putting the fate of your life if you're the defendant, and then if you're the victim, you're putting the kind of what that you want out of the outcome of the case in the hands of 12 strangers, and you know, you don't know these individuals. I mean, you can get wildly different outcomes in jury trials. So you just never know what you're going to get 100% when you go into a jury trial. So you get a fixed thing that maybe you might not be thrilled about, but you can live with both on both the defendant side and the victim side, some kind of compromise they both can live with. And then it's just over. The victim can move on. There's no appeal process unless there was ineffective assistance of counsel, which right. The prosecutor is going to make sure, you know, everything's in the up.
You can't
up.
Appeal a guilty plea because you've already pled guilty.
So yeah. I mean, the only time it would be like if you pled at arraignment. I mean, you know, the burden's very hard to do that. So it's just over, because if it goes through an appeal process, especially like on a murder case, it's going to go through all the scrutiny. And if they find that anything that went wrong in the trial, even if you thought you tried a very clean case, there could always be like something that happens, like juror misconduct, or let's say, you know, some kind of objection, all kinds of different things. It's just any kind of error can make it get sent back, and then you'd have to retry it. And retrying the case puts the victim going through all that again. But also, as time goes by, it's harder to retry cases, right? Because witnesses move away, all this different stuff becomes really hard to recreate, to track down everybody and recreate the situation. So it just puts the family through a lot, whereas if it's pled, it's just over with.
For local content like this and much more, subscribe to the Sentinel Record by visiting hotsr.com and clicking subscribe.
Is there also a practical aspect, because I've always wondered about this, because, you know, between the police and the sheriff, they probably make 500-600 arrests a year. There's no way you could take all of them to trial.
No, I mean, we don't have enough prosecutors, enough defense attorneys. There's no way, like, everything could go to trial. Right. We file usually close to 1,000 felonies per year, so there's just not enough manpower.
Even the violent ones, it would be almost impossible to take, because a trial may last a week.
Right.
So I could see where that would, just from a practical standpoint,
be impossible.
It would be, yeah.
But we do try to give the highest priority, of course, to the murders, rapes, aggravated robberies, batteries, those kind of things. Not to say that we won't. Of course, we try the property crimes as well. I tried a stolen vehicle last year. But it's just kind of, you just have to assess whether or not you can come to an agreement or not. And if you can't, then it has to go to trial.
Sometimes you get just refused. They're just like, I want to go to trial. Mm-hmm. And they have the right.
They have the right to do that.
Gotcha.
And I think the biggest thing, too, is people to understand that unless a jury trial is waived, which both sides have to agree to waive a jury trial, both the defense and the prosecution, the judge doesn't make the decision. If it's not waived, the jury makes both the guilt decision, and then they go and they make the sentencing. It's bifurcated. So the first phase is going to be just whether or not the defendant's guilty of the charged offense, or if they're guilty of a lesser included offense. And then after that, then it goes into sentencing. But both are decided by the jury. The judge has nothing to do with it and is just basically a referee.
Gotcha. Now, you had mentioned, like, you kind of wanted to explain lesser included, how that works.
Right. I think that there's often confusion in that, even though we try to do a good job of explaining it. I think it's very complicated. Basically, let's say it's a murder case, and I charge capital murder. I charge capital murder because upon reviewing that file, we determined in our office that we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that first it's, let's say it's the premeditation, that we can prove premeditation beyond a reasonable doubt. Furthermore, we have aggravating circumstances. You know, let's say two people were killed, and let's say that there was pecuniary gain. They stole the vehicle after they killed the person. We have our aggravators, and then we know they're mitigators. Let's say they were not fully educated. They were maybe had a bad childhood, all this stuff. Those all have to be beyond a reasonable doubt, the aggravators outweighing the mitigators. So we make that determination before we ever go to trial. We're not going to go to trial on capital murder unless we believe beyond a reasonable doubt we can do it. Now, the jury will hear that, but they'll also, the defense is entitled sometimes to what's called lesser included offenses. So lesser included of capital murder would be murder one. So if it's different between each subsection. So let's say we're going with premeditation. So murder one would be purpose, with the purpose of killing someone instead of planning it via premeditation. Purpose is simply walking up to someone and shooting them in the head. They'll be instructed on that, and they'll also maybe go all the way down to manslaughter. So murder, too, is knowingly killing an individual under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. So then they'll be instructed on that. Manslaughter is when you recklessly kill someone. So bearing that in mind, the jury will get instructed on all these offenses, and there's jury instructions. But we tried, you know, the law is, first you consider what's charged. And the first charge, the highest charge, is what the prosecution believes that they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Only if all 12 jurors find not guilty should they ever even consider murder one. And that's what the jury instructions, that's what the law says. You do not just throw them all on the table and decide, this one fits the best. You have to all 12 find not guilty on capital murder before you can even consider murder one. And then you have to all find not guilty on murder one before you can even go to murder two, and so on and so forth. And I do think that, you know, we try to stress it's not, at that point in time, it's not appropriate to discuss things that you feel sorry about for the defendant, or that is for sentencing. For guilt, it is simply what did the proof show for the mental state? And then, you know, you determined the sentence later, so you don't get into the mitigating circumstances at that point in time. It's just whether or not they're guilty of the charged offense. And I do think that sometimes there's compromising on that.
Right. With the lesser included, is that something that the attorneys work out ahead of time?
Yes.
Like so the defense goes, well, I want manslaughter in there, and y'all can argue with the judge, no.
Well, there's a lot of... So the rules on lesser included is it has to, by its very nature, fit into the larger offense. So if it adds an element, if it's different, then you can't use it. So like manslaughter, there's like a subsection for manslaughter. Basically, if you and your accomplices are committing a felony and recklessly cause, that wouldn't go under purpose. That doesn't go under premeditation. That goes under a felony murder. So the lesser included have to fit. By its very nature, a lesser included is going to be proved by the larger charge.
Gotcha.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, because I know I've covered trials where like they'll be on trial for first degree, and y'all, you know, during the trial will say, and second degree is an option, and manslaughter is not even on there. Mm-hmm. And then another trial, manslaughter will be on there.
It just totally depends on the facts and whether or not the case law permits having it or not. If there's no rational basis, if something is so clearly planned, for example, let's say we got the written plan, we've got it on video, and they confess that they planned the thing out for months, then there's no rational basis to go to murder one, and that's what we would argue, because it's clear it was planned, that kind of thing.
Right.
So
manslaughter wouldn't fit at all.
No,
yeah.
No.
Gotcha.
And I think that that's what goes into the not throwing all the verdicts on the table and trying to figure out which one you want to do, because by their very nature, lesser included, they're going to fit into that higher charge.
Now, one thing we wanted to talk about that Mark had suggested was... you know, that in Arkansas, I don't know if it varies state to state or not, but that alcohol or drug use is not a defense.
That's correct.
And
the guilt.
Killing somebody or anything. Yeah, only in the guilt part.
So there's a jury instruction that says voluntary intoxication is not a defense. And so it cannot be used in guilt. Like, it's something you can consider in sentencing. It's something that might make you want to give a lower sentence because they were so drunk that they didn't know what they were doing. But it is not a defense to the actual guilty part. It's just a defense or mitigation, if you will, for sentencing.
Right. But likewise, I guess, if you have a drunk driver that leaves a bar and he plows over somebody on the sidewalk, you probably couldn't go first-degree murder because there's no, you couldn't prove intent or purpose.
Right. Gotcha. So that kind of all goes together, too. I mean, however, I mean, if someone's super high and on meth and then they kill three people, you can still prove purpose because voluntary intoxication is not a defense.
Gotcha.
But with it being an element, a DWI, that's more going to be a, you know, reckless mental state.
Gotcha. And I think you also said about witnesses having to testify, like they actually have to testify in court, right?
Yes. So I think one of the misconceptions is why people get frustrated. They think that we can just use the recorded interview or the statement that was given to police and then the witness doesn't have to testify. There's the confrontational clause in the Constitution. So by law, we have to put every person on so that the accused has a right to confront them. Granted, their attorney is going to do the cross-examination, but the accused has a right to be in the courtroom and look at their accuser. And that's something that's protected. And that's when it gets particularly difficult with children victims. Because, first of all, a child has to be competent to testify. They have to know the difference between a truth and a lie. And they have to be able to tell what happened, which in front of 12 adult strangers and a bailiff and a judge and everyone, I mean, it can be pretty hard on the kid, and it can be pretty traumatic and re-victimize them. So I don't ever want to, or we don't ever want to plea a child rape case to like 30 years, but sometimes we have to because the kid just can't handle, the therapist will be telling us and the kid will be telling us they just don't want to go to trial. They'd rather be convicted of rape in a plea deal with 30 years instead of maybe getting life in a trial.
Do they ever allow video testimony?
No.
Of a child? We're like, okay.
Sometimes we'll play it if the defense attorney is impeaching the victim and like mischaracterizing what the video said. If they're referencing back to the video and then they're not characterizing it correctly, then we can play the video, but it's very narrow and when you can actually do that.
Gotcha.
Do people ever try and represent themselves?
Yes, they do.
I'd love to hear about that.
Well, I mean, in misdemeanor court, that's normal. They'll sign a waiver and that's no big deal. Felony court, we really try to avoid that because it's just not fair to the defendant. They might want to represent themselves, but they don't have a law degree. It's just setting themselves up to get a huge sentence if they do that. But, I mean, if they truly are insistent, you know, we have these steps, like waivers that are they'll sign and we'll go through, basically warning them every what a terrible idea it is to represent themselves. But they can if they really press the issue. It's not very often.
Without going to specifics, there have been, because I can remember.
I can remember at least one or two.
Like even murder cases where they.
Not with me, maybe before me.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But there's been, like, battery cases where it's happened last year or 2 years ago. I can't remember, but it's definitely happened before, serious cases.
With all these cases, have you seen any trends in your time here?
What do you mean? Like with sentences or with what kind of crime? Or what
kind of crime, sentences?
It just seems like during the summer, everything gets crazy because everyone's so hot. I don't know. That's just my theory. But it does seem like there's a spike in crime during the summer a lot. But that's just me, you know, theorizing. I don't know that there's any factual basis in that. And then as far as sentences go, you know, I can try a case and get life sentence or death penalty with no criminal history, and you wouldn't think, you know, you might think they have no criminal history, it's crazy that they got life. But then I might try a case, you know, with priors, and they might get 40 years. It just depends on your jury. So you can get wildly different outcomes. You really can't predict it. I mean, you can predict whether or not it's a solid case and you think that you'll get a strong number, but you really can't predict what a jury is going to do. I mean, it can be shocking.
Now, with the sentencing, like, I know, because I always ask you this, especially on the murders and stuff, how does one qualify for the 70%?
So that's going to be Y felonies. Obviously, capital murder is a Y felony and life is life. So that's not an option because it's either life or death penalty. But like once you get to murder one, once you get to rape, kidnapping, aggravated robbery, and a few others, then it's going to be 70%, which is doesn't matter what amount of good time you get. You just are parole eligible at 70%, and you might not even get out. I mean, on murder one, it's unlikely.
It just means you're eligible.
Yeah,
yeah. It still is up to parole board or whatever.
Yeah, and that's outside of our control, of course. That's separate from us.
So the ones, if it's not 70%, most of the time it seems like it's that half and a quarter.
So for violent, it's going to be a half and a quarter. So if it's 20 years, then you're going to be parole eligible in 5. What's crazy is when you get to the 3rd and a 6th, which is going to be like your Class D's, your C's, even some B felonies, which is shocking to me, but, like, you know, there's sexual crimes that are only a 3rd and a 6th, which is shocking, but you're talking really cutting down your time at that point. You're talking about 2 months per year, basically.
But now, it's not automatic. There has to be, like, good behavior and some factors.
Right, so if you get all your good time, then it's going to be cut down by first a 3rd and then a 6th if you get all your good time. If you're the worst prisoner ever, then it's just going to be a 6.
So, like, if somebody got 30 years, like, automatically it's going to cut. Does it cut down to 10, or is it just cut by a 3rd?
Oh, you know I can't do math.
But sorry, yeah.
You just do a 3rd. So if it's 30 years, you cut down that by a 3rd. And then at that point in time, that's if they're worst prisoner ever. And then if they're a great prisoner, then they get a 6th of it cut down, and then they're even more. So the easiest way to explain it is 2 months for every year that they serve.
Gotcha. But that, like, good time would be like they're taking their classes and counseling. And
staying out of trouble, not getting in fights, being compliant with orders, that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
This has been an episode of Inside the Newsroom. New episodes are released every Thursday. Thank you for listening.